Author of the Week, with Jessica Burtis, Alex Lefchuk, and of course, another sensationally talented purveyor of perfect prose. Wow, a lot of alliteration from an anxious announcer placed in a powerful post.
Molecular biology, genetics, cell biology, all wondrous subjects, and indeed subjects which you'd say hard science fiction writers would certainly draw upon. But how does that fit within urban fantasy? Well, we'll find out over the course of the next 25 minutes to half an hour, because we are delighted to welcome the awesomely talented urban fantasy expert and indeed creator of Owl and the Japanese Circus and much, much more. It's the fabulous Christy Cherish. How are you, Christy?
I'm doing great. Was that ever an incredibly flattering introduction? And thanks for having me, Alex.
Christy, when you've got a science background, I always feel you have to support ourselves. I my first degree was chemistry and biology, so I kind of can empathize with respect to where you're coming from that point of view. Mind you, that was back in the 20th century, so let's move on from there. But it is interesting in terms of, you say you draw upon, obviously, your expertise in the sciences. I mean, you got a PhD in zoology from the University of British Columbia and so on, specializing in genetics, cell biology, and so on. That's a little bit unusual, because normally you find that, again, hard science writers, like Kim Stanley Robinson, for instance, they'll focus on the sort of hard science, Arthur C. Clarke and so on. They wouldn't necessarily write urban fantasy.
Yeah, and you know, another example too is Michael Crichton, who did a medical degree and of course did Jurassic Park and all, and he also did some Andromeda Strain with the viruses.
Prefiguring that. And Westworld. Let's not forget Westworld.
Oh gosh, yes. I just finished watching that. That was a brilliant. So I need to go back. I've been trying to go back and get the original script that he wrote for the movie in the 1970s. Yeah. And it's hard to track down. Because I, again, being a scientist, anytime I see something like that, I like to go back to the original source and say, okay, well, how was it adapted? What did they do? Where does the science degree come in? There are a couple of ways to answer that question. And I would say the first way is that, when you're doing a science degree, and you would know this from research as well, is that there is an incredible amount of art that goes into the research component. Once you've finished your initial degree, once you've done all the memorization, the memorization part and the test taking isn't actually a great primer if you want to go into a science career. You're better off doing mixing some arts in there as well. And part of that is that, unlike when you're writing an exam, you've got to go back. When you're doing an experiment, you can't go back and see what the answer is. You don't know what the answer is because you're asking a question that hasn't been answered before, whether it's, hey, is this particular gene or chemical? Is this a particular chemical or this, isomer of this chemical? Is it involved in cancer? Is it involved in, does it have a different function in a different cellular system? Is a probe, so what I used to work on was, is this protein, very upper level, no details, is this particular protein, a gene, is it involved in cancer? Is it, if I break it, do I get cancerous like result? And the artistic component comes in that there is no answer out there that you can find in a textbook. You've got to come up with a way to ask the question in creative ways, and then interpret your result. And so there's actually a lot of similarity with writing, I find. And at least for me, when I'm plotting out a novel, I'll sit there and I'll go, all right, well, I've got this, question. If I look at my characters or I look at an idea for a book as the experiment, I'll write different scenes. I'll see if they work. Then the results and the analysis is, do I believe this? Am I able to suspend my disbelief for, a few minutes to keep going on to the next section? So there is a lot of experimentation, I find, in the writing process. So it's that artistic questioning and also, this idea of constantly questioning your assumptions, and your own interpretations. That's sort of a hallmark of good science. And I think, you know, all across the world, that's every science program, that's what they're trying to browbeat into you, is you constantly need to be checking your ego at the door and questioning your own assumptions. And, I think that entire skill set is very complementary to arts and writing. And I think you see that sort of, you see that idea borne out in the data out there, in that you do have an awful lot of successful commercial fiction authors who had their start in arts degrees or science degrees. A lot of them have their start in arts degrees, but there's an incredible number who also started off in the sciences. Dinah Gabaldon, who of course did the Outlander series, had her start in marine biology. Michael Crichton was medical. Peter Watts, who does science fiction in Canada, is another science alumni from UBC. So, you know, it's, yeah.
I think that the point is that actually you need to have an awareness and a curiosity about life. And this artificial distinction that certainly manifested itself through a considerable period, really, of the 20th century, because before then, the 19th century, the notion of natural science and being a natural philosopher was very much in keeping with the arts and the humanities and so on. And there was a period of several decades, I think, within the 20s, where specialization became hyper-specializations, and people very much were given the choice, certainly at the school basis, of where you either go down the arts or the humanities route, or you go down the science route. I can't tell you the shock that I generated when I actually decided to do a chemistry and biology degree, as opposed to going down the drama and humanities route, although I did return to do the master's in film and media, etc. But ultimately, it's a case of how you relate to that and how we actually sort of connect with that. Fundamentally, as I'm sure you'll appreciate, the double helical structure of deoxyribonucleic acid, it's a fantastically inspirational aspect, which of course created all the wonderful things that we see today, including the fact that we can actually communicate via Zoom as well, in an indirect sense. As Carl Sagan once said, another scientist who, again, sadly no longer with us, but these are some of the things hydrogen atoms can evolve to, given several billion years of cosmic evolution. One of my own personal favorite quotes in terms of how we work through that. I think we were joined very briefly there by Jessica, but she's probably phased in and phased out like some sort of wonderful North Carolina ghost, but we'll carry on. In terms of Owl and the Japanese Circus and the line that we actually get with respect to that, and of course, Owl and the Tiger Thieves and so on, an urban fantasy series about ex-archaeology grad students turned international antiquities thief, Alex, of course, better known as Owl, and it's A-L-I-X before people say, what's going on here? A-L-I-X from that point of view. So again, a modern-day Indiana Jane, as opposed to presumably Lara Croft, in which case, where do we go with respect to that? Was that something which, again, you thought, yeah, actually, I quite like the archaeology and the antiquity side of things as well?
I did. So when I started off doing, I started off on my sort of graduate school, undergrad career. I very much like yourself, people were kind of shocked when I eventually went into the sciences and genetics, because I was very much the arts, drama, English literature student in high school. And I'd always convince myself, I'm no good at math. I'm no good at chemistry. I'm not great at these, you know, equations. So I'm not going to be, I'm not going to be able to do this. What ended up happening was, as I went into archaeology to start off with, archaeology, anthropology, and I loved Indiana Jones. And I think every student at some point who's going into archaeology, anthropology, they're told it's not Indiana Jones. And you're told that on your first day of class. There's no Indiana Jones.
George Lucas has a lot to answer for, Christy.
He really does.
I'm sure you don't get you won't get the equivalent of agriculture students being told it's not Luke Skywalker, will you? You know, it's not Luke Skywalker going to farming.
So, but everybody has that hope in the back of their head that, well, maybe, you know, if I just stick it out long enough, I'll eventually get to the Indiana Jones part. I greatly enjoyed my first year of university, but I rapidly ended up in biology and directed towards biology. And there were a couple of reasons for that. I was lucky enough to be in Brita Galdikas's class, anthropology class. And she's, if you eat Diane Fossey and Jane Goodall, chimpanzees and gorillas, and then Brita Galdikas did orangutans. So they were all that, they were the trio at the time who were doing the primate research. So our archaeology anthropology class wonderfully ended up being an introduction to primatology and human evolution and a lot of science. And I found that I adored that. I just the biology questions that came out of it. And so, but for me, sort of the nail in the coffin of my archaeology component, my archaeology career, very, very brief archaeology career, stint, was that one of the TAs brought a question that had come up in the news, which had to do with remains that had been found and the dating and whether or not they should be genetically tested. And of course, me being a little more sciencely inclined was like, yes, of course, we should absolutely be looking. You know, it's important to know. And archaeology still being very much having a foot in the arts at the time was the opposite answer. And the rest of the class and the TA and everybody was like, no, it's an art. We have to respect, we have to respect the politics and the culture. And so I very quickly realized I was in the wrong place for the kinds of questions my brain wanted to ask. And that thought process, that whole feeling I had of being in the wrong place and just needing to, move myself, that was kind of the inspiration for Owl, where she ends up in this very clandestine organization of graduate students and graduate studies, where they're trying to hide the supernatural world and trying to cover everything up. And she, of course, gets caught up in it. So again, it was sort of that grain of sand from my experience and that ended up morphing and mutating into an urban fantasy novel.
Which makes perfect sense. And indeed, our very own urban fantasy heroine from, of course, the joys of North Carolina has finally managed to come and join us and stay with us, as opposed to phasing in, phasing out, etc. Some kind of will-o'-the-wisp. Jessica Burtis, how are you, Jessica?
I am okay. I actually graduated like a few hours ago.
Wow. Hey, congratulations, Jessica Burtis. This is fantastic. Yeah. This shows the ultimate commitment. You see, Jessica Burtis, the day of her graduation, she still joins us on a midweek drive connection. This is outstandingly wonderful. Jessica, you duly get top box from that point of view. And I'm sure Christy would agree with me. From other words, great to see that's happened.
Thank you. Absolutely.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. It's so interesting hearing you talk, like discussions around like colleges and university and like modes of study, like what fields people are going into. It's nice. I'm like on my graduation day, I don't know, just like reflecting on all that. It's very interesting.
Excellent. Well, again, congratulations and richly deserved, Jessica. Obviously, you now appreciate you do have to write the great American novel that we've spoken about. And who better to actually provide some advice than Christy, obviously a great creator who's online at present. Jessica, if you had a chance to have a look at some of the work that we've put here, as a Small Things in Unprecedented Times, the title of Christy's latest blog entry. But Jessica, any questions you'd like to put to Christy at present?
This is a bit left field, but I was curious, since you're talking about kind of science-related things and also that your book is paranormal, I'm very curious, do you believe in ghosts and like the paranormal? Have you ever had like an experience like that?
I have it. Let's unpacking that. I think it's a human condition that our brains are so creative and they will come up. They come up with answers to things that scare us or surprise us. Or so I think everybody on the planet has had something that kind of feels like, or that they are convinced, or that they feel, and to them is, you know, it's a ghost, or it's a haunting, or my gosh, I heard a noise. The only explanation is, is a ghost. And I used to have that experience. I'm from the wet coast, so Pacific Northwest. And in the middle of winter, I grew up in a forest while I was in high school. And it gets darker early in the middle of winter. And so I had this kilometer long driveway that I had to hike up all the way uphill during when I get home from school. And there were days where it was getting dark. You've got this darkened forest. So it's a little light outside, and then you get into the forest. And, you know, the teenage mind is a wonderful thing. And the number of times I was convinced, oh, there's something, you know, you're sort of looking over your shoulder and your brain is going, I know it's a deer. I know it's a raccoon. But there's a part of your brain that's like, are you sure? Are you 100% certain? So that's, you know, that's where I can certainly, I don't believe in ghosts and, you know, the paranormal, but I understand how it can feel very real, if that makes sense. That's sort of my perspective from it.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. I think the mind is such a powerful thing. So it's really interesting when, you know, people, like our brains start playing tricks on us, and all minds are very creative, even if people don't think they are, because they will start imagining like terrifying things in the dark, no matter how mathematically oriented.
And there's the aspect too of our memories. Our memories over time are not accurate. You can remember a conversation, like there's a difference between last week remembering a conversation and then 15 years later trying to recall it. And your brain will have added things in. Maybe they're accurate, maybe they're not. And I think that plays into it a bit too. So
in terms of characters, because clearly that's something which comes across very much from your writing, Christy, whether it's a case of Alex, our wonderful Indiana Jones, but better, and indeed the notion of Kincaid Strange, of course, in terms of voodoo killings. As Canadian Living says, if you're a fan of Buffy Summers and Suki Stackhouse, you'll definitely like Kincaid Strange. Are these things that had kind of influenced you growing up? Because obviously we've shared your kind of love of writers like Michael Crichton and so on in terms of that sort of aspect. So was this something where you sort of thought, yeah, actually Joss Whedon and Jane Espenson, they've got a lot to answer for?
I definitely, those shows were on TV while I was in, while I was in university. So, you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, of course, we watched on, it would be an event because of course we didn't have streaming at the time. So you'd have to be there in front of the television set when it was airing.
And you had the video cassette, you had VHS, you could have recorded.
Yeah, but that involved a trip to the library and having a VHS that could do it. So, so that stuff is very influential. I think during the 90s, you know, there's the whole bit from the 80s where, you know, video games were starting to become popular in the 90s. Story in video games was the immersive story, which is certainly a very, I write first person narrative. So that's been, I think, incredibly influential for me. But also, you know, the 80s and the 90s was kind of the introduction of the urban fantasy female protagonist, which is, has a lot of hallmarks of, you know, sort of this aspects of the feminist movement, and having to deal with, okay, we've gotten part of the way, but there's still all this stuff in the working world, in leaving your house, in trying to get a job, and yes, a historical example is up until the 1970s in Canada, and I know the US and I believe in Canada as well. Imagine being in the 1970s, which doesn't seem that long ago, and wanting to go to university and get your own apartment.
Before Jessica was born, Chris, was born, Christy.
Before Jessica was born, but, and you know, I was you know, the late 70s is when I was kind of born. But it's, you know, in the grand scheme of things, you know, we still have movies that we're watching from the 1970s, which is, you know, of course, Star Wars and, you know, Indiana Jones and that 70s and 80s. If you were a woman wanting to go to university, you wanted to move out on your own, you needed your dad's permission. So if you think about that, you know, as recently as the 70s, what if your dad says no? You know,
honestly, Christy, you Canadians, where's the liberation movement in Canada? I mean, that's outrageous.
Well, and again, of course, that was the 1970s. Of course, that went away. I believe in the 80s that was gone. But, you know, you think about that, you've got women in the 80s and 90s who would have lived through that, that experience of having to negotiate. Yeah, I can have a job. I can go to university. I have this independence. And I still need a man from my family to give me permission to live on my own until I'm married, you know. And I think we have a very short memory for that kind of thing. And I think there was a female protagonist that came out in the 80s and the 90s. So the Buffy Summers and, you know, even Lara Croft to a degree from the video game, where they were having to deal, I think, with just the emotional and even just... you know, other issues of being a woman in the workplace. A great scene if people are interested in going back and seeing it. And again, I watched the movie as a kid, and then later on, you know, as an adult, just having my jaw drop, was Die Hard with Bruce Willis. It's kind of, in North America, it's a bit of a Christmas classic. It's
become a cult Christmas classic. And
if you see his ex-wife, who is, you know, this... a banking executive, I believe, and just the blatant sexual harassment that was in the movie. And at the time, people were just kind of nodding, oh yeah, that happens at work, you know. And looking back at it and going, my goodness, how was that, you know, it's just the perspective has changed so much. So I think there was some very interesting female protagonists that came out of that era, that age, that I, of course, being a young woman, was influenced reading about and reading their perspectives, even though I hadn't experienced that particular phase of North American feminist evolution. So,
of course, there was always
long-winded answer.
there was always Lindsay Wagner's incarnation of Jamie Summers and the Bionic Woman in the 1970s, and I don't think anybody would have messed around with Jamie Summers. I just put that out there from that point of view. Jessica, I mean, clearly in North Carolina, it was only a matter of years ago that actually women were allowed to vote. Only kidding, North Carolina. So what are your thoughts and questions from this point of view on this, the day of your graduation?
Well, I think I like, you know, that discussion around like heroines and certain iconic figures. But I want to ask a quick question. What was probably your biggest challenge writing, and what advice would you offer to someone who wants to write a book and might face a similar challenge? Maybe asking for myself, but.
one of the things I recommend is exploring a lot of, exploring things outside the MFA program for students who are in the MFA. I think there's rich material in other, you know, hobbies or other interests, things like that. You know, and it my next would be, you know, it seems glib, but finishing the novel is, you know, is I think one of the best pieces of advice I was given, and helps me to this day. It's like, yes, it's not going to look perfect that first way through. And by the time I'm at chapter 5, on a manuscript right now, I get to chapter 5 and I'm like, oh, I need to change that character in chapter 3 already. And I know I need to go back and do some work on that character, but I can't do it now. I need to finish the novel. Otherwise, every time I get a few, you know, another 10,000 words further, there's going to be something at the beginning of the book that I need to go back and change. And if I continuously do that, I'm never going to get to the end, or it's going to take me a really long time to get to the end. That's also a commercial fiction perspective. Being in the commercial sort of area, for a small group, that commercial component of fiction, you got to get the novel done and into your agent's hand, and hopefully into an editor's hand at publishing house, or if you're going the self-publishing route, then to an editor and to the audience. Otherwise, and it's the academic in me too, the feedback that you're going to get, the work I did with editors and my agent, is almost like a master's class in itself in what things I'm good at, but also what I need to work on. And I see a lot of writers out there who are so talented and have so much to say, and they allow themselves to be petrified by the idea of finishing a manuscript that isn't perfect. So that was the advice that I got that I found very, very useful when I followed it. So that's that one piece I put out there. But everybody has such a different pathway to becoming an author and finishing a novel. And it is so personal. So, it's one of those things where you just got to do what feels right for you to a degree, because one person's advice and what works for one person is not going to work for you. So yeah, it's one of those things with writing that there is no easy answer to what's going to work for everyone. I think Stephen King in his On Writing has some of the best writing advice on the planet. So I always try and direct people towards that as well.
Yeah, I like what you said. Like, there isn't an easy like trick that can just make you do something. Like, you got to just push through it and like write that bad first draft, even if that's what it takes. Like, that's that first step. So thank you.
Absolutely awesome. And indeed, you can actually go to one of the lines that was put together by Ian Hamilton about Owl, an archaeologist, renegade, fantasy game lover, and thief who lives in a wacky world populated by dragons, Nagus, and vampires. The world, of course, of Owl. Do you like Owl, Christy? Because, some authors, they don't like their characters. Do you think, is she the sort of person who you would like to hang out with? Or is it just a case of, no, I might write your script, love, but I can't stand you in real life?
Because I write first person narrative, there's a component of me that goes into all my characters. So of course I love writing Owl, because I get to put myself into, there's a bit of an acting component to as well when you write first person narrative, because you're creating the voice in your head and then you're writing in that character's voice for the entire novel. And I do that with Kincaid Strange too. That's kind of my happy spot when I'm writing. So I think I kind of have to like, there are things about my characters that I hate, but I kind of have to love them because, it's part of me. It's not, of course, all of me on the page, but it's part of me and how I would maybe react in a situation, or how I would imagine reacting in a particular situation on the page. So.
Love me, love my characters, quite clearly. Yeah. It's quite evident. And in terms of your science work, ever been tempted to go back to the research route and say, actually, I'll chuck in this urban fantasy now. I'm actually going to become a research scientist.
I don't know if I would be able to get straight back into the research game, but I definitely, I try not to rule anything out. And I don't think anybody should rule anything out, because the way that careers work now, things can change on a dime. It's not like there was sort of this myth of, you get a company or a university job and that's it for, the rest of your life. And nowadays it doesn't, our interests and just the world around us can really influence what we do. I think the area that I would want to go back into is science education, and the research around science education. And that's part of my, introduction to the fiction world. Something I noticed being a researcher, and one of the most frustrating things was that I understand, for example, with the global pandemic that's around us now, I understand cell biology. I understand a lot of the science behind research that's going on and vaccines and all of that. But you know, we see quite clearly that a lot of the world doesn't have that science education. And, you know, it's where, you know, one of the places I've noticed people do get their science education from, where it sticks and they understand it, is from a really great narrative. You know, people might not remember a cancer story or the biology of a cancer story that appears in the New York Times, but man, they remember Star Wars. You know, it's and of course, from that, there's still a component of the world that thinks a starship banks in space, which is a problem. And so I'm fascinated by the use of narrative in video games and in fiction. You know, like Jurassic Park, Michael Crichton's Jurassic Park, everybody knows DNA, everybody knows about frogs because they remember it from the story. So that's an area I would definitely look at going into, but it's complementary with my background and what I've been doing for the past few years. So I wouldn't rule it out, but I probably wouldn't go straight back into the genetics fly lab.
And finally, as I say, this is Jessica Burtis's special graduation day. Have you got any advice, Christy, you'd like to put to Jessica? As I mean, she's a AAA grade, platinum clad member of the Madrid Drive. She launched her career with us about a year ago when she was an exchange student at the University of Lincoln. We're delighted to actually feature her on a regular basis and say high praise for actually joining us on our graduation day. Any advice you'd like to give Jessica as she heads off into a whole new, brave new North Carolina sweet tea and boiled peanut world?
Oh man, just the fact, Jessica, that you have finished your degree and you've gotten to the finish line, definitely congratulate yourself and spend some time congratulating yourself over that, because that is just such a colossal achievement. You know, the dedication that it takes to get through and finish that degree.
And to the pandemic as well.
I know. You know, definitely spend some time congratulating yourself for that, because you absolutely deserve it. And thinking about what you want to do next, if you aren't 100% sure, but it sounds like you've already got an idea of where your career is going to be going. But that would be it. But yeah, what an achievement. It's always great to hear when somebody else has gotten through the academic gauntlet.
Yes, I thank you.
Gauntlet.
I feel like I've been through like an entire like science fiction novel this whole year, and it's just been something else. So graduation was bizarre and everything, but I'm so glad it's done. And I'm really happy that I could be here today too and just talk to you both and hear about your book, because it's just, I love hearing about these things. And I think it sounds super interesting. I love the name Electric Samurai for like the villain. Oh, that was so cool.
Very much, guys. ChristyCharish.com, presumably the best website to actually go to, Christy, to find out further details about what we've been speaking about today.
Yep, that would be it. On Twitter as well, but my website's a great spot.
And just confirming, whereabouts in Canada are you based at present?
Vancouver. So I'm on the Pacific Northwest West Wet Coast.
So it's a nice, bright, early morning there from that point of view. And if you look out the window, you'll probably see remnants of the X-Files being shot back in a time-traveling day and other sort of exciting things as well. It's amazing.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, Dana Scully was pretty good as well from that point of view, and a kind of precursor to Buffy the Vampire Slayer. There was always Dana
Scully.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. That's another great one.
So two final questions for your good self. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today, Christy?
Are you kidding? I've had a fantastic time. Hopefully I haven't given you guys too long-winded answers, but this has been a blast.
It's always been fantastic. So the next critical question is, will you come back and join us again in the not-too-distant future?
Absolutely.
Dr. Christy Charish, huge thanks. Keep on keeping on. And I won't say May the 4th be with you, because we've already passed that day. It's a whole new world. But still, life continues, and keep on keeping on. Bye for now.
Jessica Burtis, flying the flag for North Carolina across the solar system.
Did you know that in 1991, a bill was passed by the North Carolina Senate changing the official proportions of the state flag from a length one-third more than its width to a length one-half more than its width?
Wow, there must not be a lot going on in the North Carolina Senate for them to have that kind of time on their hands.
When you're described as an enigmatic frontman with Claire and Annalise on bass and guitar, you can only be describing the Pocket God's wondrous enigmatic frontman. It's Mark Christopher Lee. How are you, Mark?
Yeah, I'm okay, thank you. Yeah, how are you?
Well, great to connect with you, good self. Finally, we've had a couple of false starts over the last few weeks, but now all is well with the world, and here you are. About to almost go ... No, that's not going to help the matter. But thanks to Samuel Morse, of course, that's at the heart of the latest Pocket Gods experience. Share with us what's been happening.
Yeah, it's probably the world's most tedious album, I have to say, but I have recorded it. It's basically every day in English lockdown since March last year. I put the date, converted it into Morse code, and then transposed that onto piano. So each day has its own 30-second piece of piano, which is Morse code for the actual date of lockdown. It's, you know, it sums up the boredom and insanity of lockdown.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because obviously it can be half full, the glass, that is. It can be half empty. Mm. There are folk who are actually talking about COVID dividends, COVID bonuses, etc. The fact that we're doing what we are doing now, which a year and a half ago, we would have said it's the stuff of science fiction or perhaps Skype, maybe, using this sort of medium of connecting with other folk, etc. Yeah. Has it all been bleak and doom and gloom, or has it been a case of, well, actually, maybe this is working through it?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've made the most of it in terms of music. I have put out a lot of stuff under the Pocket Gods and also other bands like the Kill the Giants.
You made your debut on the Midweek Drive.
Well, indeed, yeah. So we've been, you know, been quite creative, you know, and it has been difficult. I mean, I did the album also to raise awareness of those with mental health issues, which has been particularly hard in lockdown. Myself included, especially as, you know, personally, I was waiting for treatment to start. That, like a lot of people, that got delayed because of the lockdown and the pandemic. I was just trying to raise awareness of that as well as a positive point, really.
I think you've certainly done. Now, as I say, the album, it's got 456, that's 456 tracks. They all actually sort of last around about 30 seconds long. And of course, it is interesting because it's there as a protest against the continuing lockdown. So it's not just a case of saying this is St. Albans, Hertfordshire against the world. It's a sort of generic sort of thing from that point of view. Is this something, I mean, in terms of Morse code, I've got to say my understanding of Morse code is very limited, et cetera. I mean, you know, technologically, one could actually sort of go through a range of sort of aspects. And obviously, as you say, we're using Zoom to actually get messages out from that point of view. We can put all sorts of other sort of different messages, et cetera, to the form. And there's a message that I've actually put on screen now, which is a because we're joined by our fabulous Jessica Burtis from North Carolina. So hopefully you've actually got that message quite clearly. In front of your good self, but congratulations on graduating. How has lockdown been in North Carolina, Jessica, during your graduation?
It's been bizarre. It was so strange. For graduation, they actually like had us all, like they broke up the ceremony. So there were like 12 small ones and our chairs were all like 6 feet apart. And it was just like, it was a very strange affair, I think. But they put an emphasis. They were like, you guys spent your last three semesters of university in a pandemic. So I'm sorry about that. It's like, yeah, but at least it's over. Well, college, but
yeah, pandemic still got a little ways to go yet, but we'll just have to wait and see with respect to that. I mean, Mark, there's an example of a fabulous American who has spent some time over in Lincoln with us. She's going to go through that. Again, it's one of those areas where presumably, was that the sort of message you wanted to get out in terms of your Morse coded songs?
Yeah, I think there's been a bit, lockdown has had an impact on various people, especially young people. and you know, people at university and colleges and things like that haven't been able to study properly. Kids not being able to take their exams, things like that. So it has had a widespread impact on everyone, really. And my issue is that the pros and cons of lockdown haven't really been discussed in any detail. The cost benefit of lockdowns hasn't really been disclosed scientifically. I think there's certain states in America, I'm not entirely sure, that like Florida, for instance, that haven't had such you know, hard lockdowns, that seem to be doing okay, especially
in Texas, of course.
Awesome, Texas, yeah, absolutely, yeah. So, you know, and Sweden, people were criticising Sweden on the early days, but seems to have come through relatively okay without damaging its economy and people's lives so much.
I mean, it opens up a whole range of things. And again, the interesting thing about this particular album is it also contains hidden messages for those with time and enthusiasm for deciphering it. I mean, I don't know, Jessica, now that you've graduated, have you sort of given any thought about it in terms of learning Morse code and saying, I'm going to actually get that Pocket Gods album and see what hidden messages they put in there?
Morse code is so interesting. I remember there was like always jokes about like people like clicking their pens and accidentally talking in like Morse code and stuff, but I always see it like the old television shows and the Telegraph and everything like that. It's very interesting.
Well, I think one of the ideas with the album is using a very, very, one of the first communication technologies. I'm actually putting it on Spotify, etc., all the high-tech streaming services. So it's quite a, I don't know,
it's making this whole thing. Of course, your previous albums of 30-second tracks, I'll say that again, 30-second tracks. So actually, in the time we've been doing this interview with Mark so far, then in essence, you've probably already had 10 albums released already in terms of that. It's just been literally relentless. They've also gained you official Guinness World Records status for the most tracks on a digital album, which, as you've just pointed out, this particular one smashes the current record of 300 by a considerable distance. Was that also in your mind in terms of, yeah, we want to actually do something which is quite surreal, but also actually sort of transverts the whole thing into music for the piano? Yeah. Just talk us through that process once again, because I think it's fascinating from Jessica's point of view.
Well, the original idea came quite about 2018, I think it was. And I read an article in the Independent newspaper, and it said, because streaming services pay a royalty once a track hits 30 seconds, why do people write longer songs nowadays? Because you don't get paid anymore. You get paid very little anyway. So why don't artists just do 30-second songs? So I took that seriously, went away, and made an album of 100 songs, all 30 seconds long. I did 100 to max out the royalties. And that then gained the official world record for most tracks on an album. And then other people have come along and broke the record, but I've always gone back and retaken it. So this time I'll give myself plenty of space by doing 456 tracks. So,
yeah, but then 456, as we said, that's a considerable number of tracks on my period. And yet, tragically, the Morse code beat, I just can't find myself dancing or getting into the rhythm at all. You know, I kind of try and I just not going to work, you know?
It's an unlistenable album, really. It's done for a bit of a concept. The way I'm coming from musically is from avant-garde composers such as John Cale, Morton Feldman, both from the New York Academy. And Morton Feldman was a composer who specialised in doing extreme works, really like a concerto that lasted all day. So the musicians would play it and then would get absolutely knackered because they were worn out. So I'm taking this to a new level. And my next thing, what I'm doing at right this minute, is I'm recording the world's longest song, and it's 48 hours long. It's one song.
Sounds as though this could actually be the song that the Appalachian State University actually needs to actually have an expanded version, a full 48-hour song, 48-hour-long song, which, you know, could actually... It's great. I think it could work on it. Because sometimes these graduations, Jessica, they can go on and on and on and on.
2 days of partying, just press play, go off and party, and then that's good.
Exactly.
Any questions, Jessica, you'd like to put to Mark at this moment?
I'm very curious, how do you go about like coming up with original concepts for like that many little bite-sized songs? Like, how do you kind of keep it original? Like, is it like little jingles each one? Like, what?
There's different ways of doing that. I usually come up with a concept for each album. For instance, I've done one on the music industry. So I just write the titles down, and then did one on the Soccer World Cup a few years back. And then I did one on my favorite TV program, The X-Files. So every episode of The X-Files had a 30-second song. You get the idea, and then you get the titles, and you can just, 30 seconds doesn't take too much to get it.
Talking about The X-Files, and let's look at an episode that I know Jessica and myself actually looked at for Resonance Rewind. Can you remember the sort of theme that you had for Postmodern Prometheus, the season 5 episode of The X-Files?
That's the Cher one, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
It was, yeah. And that was a really, really good postmodern episode, wasn't it? Where they hark back to the
Ingolstadt.
Yeah. And Frankenstein, the 20s kind of. Yeah, it was really good, that one.
Yeah.
But yeah, I can't remember the music so much, apart from the Cher bit at the end.
Yeah, well, you could have had Walking in Memphis, but I think the royalties wouldn't have necessarily gone on that sort of basis. So what the heck, you know? Gypsies, Tramps and Thieves. Cher's music was woven in throughout the entire episode, basically.
Yeah.
So it goes. In fact, Mark Snow probably took a day off. You know, he's probably still saying, "Oh, what the hey? I'll just leave that and compose something else from that point of view."
Probably did, yeah.
In terms of, is there something about St Albans in Hertfordshire that actually leads itself to creativity? I mean, you know, Kill the Giants, Pocket Gods, etc. There seems to be a constant sort of wellness of what I consider to be the music of the weird in many ways. Is that
that's
a fair
point?
Nice. Slightly
weird.
Yeah,
well, The most famous band from St Albans was a 60s band, The Zombies, who had hits with She's Not There and Time of the Season. They were a big kind of psychedelic band, late 60s. Wow. They're still going now. So I call myself the second biggest band in my village because they live, a couple of them live in the same village. So.
Again, just wondrous. I mean, Jessica, have you ever sort of considered I know you're going to write the Great American Novel. That's already done and dusted, so you're working on that. But have you ever considered sort of entering a sort of musical sort of theme on this side of things?
I am not musical.
I thought that was a very musical sort of breakdown there. I mean, you just said, I am not musical. You know, it goes crazy. It's great, you know.
I am not musical at all, so I do not think that anything with music is in my future, aside from listening to it. But I'm actually trying to imagine going to a concert where like every song is like 30 seconds and like the crowd has to like keep up. But yeah, I think I'm gonna stick to books for now.
It's interesting you say that, because as a band, playing the 30-second songs is really, really difficult. So you're doing a gig, say it's about 45 minutes long. That's a lot of 30-second songs. That's nearly 90. And you've got to, as the singer, you've got to try and remember all the words. So it's and it's hard doing 30 seconds because it's hard to get in the groove straight away, because most songs are like 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, so you've got time to get into it. Whereas as soon as the song's started, it's almost finished.
That's true. Yeah, it'll keep
The audience reaction is very good, because they've never seen anything like it before. It's like, oh, is that it? That's good. Oh, there's another one. It's like a really speeded up Ramones, because the Ramones used to do short songs, but...
Yeah, but I mean, if Joey Ramone is looking down, would he actually turn around and say, yeah, that's ultimately where we would have been going, as many tracks as we can fit on an album?
Probably, yeah.
Talk to us about Claire and Annalise, your wonderful sort of bass and guitar contributors to the Pocket Gods, etc. How do they fit into the whole picture? Do they actually lead anything into the songwriting process?
Well, Claire and Annalise were long-term members. Claire is actually my wife, as bass player, and Annalise is her cousin. So it's a family kind of a band, and it's always been good having...
It's like the Partridge Family, but not as many members, and real life as opposed to fictional, then.
Yeah, basically, yeah. No, it's good fun. We all get on really well. And the other main member who you haven't mentioned is Noel Story, who's the keyboard player. Me and him are both original members, which go back to 1997. So we started the band back then, still going
now. 20th century then, basically, before Jessica was born, which we've said earlier today. You know, this is the sort of routine.
You know? I'm feeling old now.
is there? Influencers, of course, include the Pixies, Graham Parsons, Absinthe, Syd Barrett, of course, presumably from his Pink Floyd days, and those lovable lads from Liverpool, the Beatles. Is that kind of early Beatles or late Beatles?
I love everything, really, by the Beatles. Obviously, the early rock and roll stuff has an impact, but then they created kind of modern-day indie rock, experimental pop. They were brilliant, yeah.
We mentioned, of course, the wondrous words of the Ramones, Joy Division, William Peter Blatty. Interesting. Exorcist moment there, obviously. I wasn't aware of the musician.
My two favourite films are Exorcist 1 and Exorcist 3. Exorcist 2 with Richard Burton, that's absolutely hilarious, hilariously bad. I don't know if you've seen it. The one and three, which...
Mark, I know this might shock you, but I tend to actually give any movies with projectile vomiting in it a big miss. You know, I just sort of think, no. It's certain things I just think, no. You know, it's the reason with Nomadland. I mean, great that Frances McDormand actually won the whole thing, but, you know, too much urination and defecation for my liking. You know, just step away from that. It's not good. Not pleasant, and it's there's no need. The Doors, of course, we mentioned that in terms of perception and the aspects related to that. Share with us, Mark, again, I'm not sure Jessica was around when you made your debut on the show, the connection, of course, with Christopher, of course, Mark Christopher Lee, and why that also, the Dwayne, of course, of so much horror, and of course, Pistol Scaramanga in the James Bond Man with the Golden Gun, is also connected with yourself.
Is he?
You've got the Christopher Lee name. I'm sure there was a story.
Yeah, my name's Mark Christopher Lee. I actually changed my name for family reasons about 15 years ago. And then I needed a middle name, so I chose Christopher because my favourite actor was Christopher Lee.
You could have gone Francis, but then he would have been a footballer who went into toilet manufacturing sales. What the heck?
It wasn't a soccer player.
Different. There's also a Francis Lee as a director as well. I get them easily confused. You know, one was a footballer playing for Manchester City. The other one, obviously, a film director. So it goes.
Okay.
Mark, we've been asking today for contributors, including us, our earlier author of the week, to share some sage words of advice with our awesome graduate, of course. Congratulations, Jessica, who's graduated obviously from her base in North Carolina and the University of Appalachian. So what advice would you give on this, her graduation day?
Okay, well, I'm not usually one for giving advice, but what I would say, whatever comes, follow your path. If you don't get that hell yeah factor in what you're planning to do, then don't do it. You've got to love what you do. And if you've got that hell yeah feeling, yeah, I want to do that, do it. If you don't get that feeling, don't do it.
That's actually very good advice. It actually reminds me, I can remember when I first started university, I was like thinking of all these different career paths because I was like, oh, everyone told me that I would never make a good career out of doing English. And I was so distraught. I remember it was actually the priest at our church was like, you gotta do what you're passionate about and like just do what like is calling to you and everything else will work itself out.
Yeah,
like
I think that's brilliant. Yeah, well done. Do that. Yeah.
And the great news, of course, with respect to that, Jessica, is your priest wasn't the exorcist in disguise. So that's all good, you know, from that point of view. So again, step away from that, move into the 30-second lines. It's very important. Mark, how can people get in touch with Pocket Gods and Kill the Giants and indeed find out about this album? What are the basic ways you would point them? Where would you point folk to go to?
Yeah, Pocket Gods. We're on Facebook, The Pocket Gods. We're on Twitter, at The Pocket God. They're the best places to find us. Our music is everywhere. Just type in The Pocket Gods into Google or whatever, and you'll find about 3,000 tracks. And about, we've recorded 70 albums, 64 EPs, and about 25 singles so far. So
lots of material there, which clearly demonstrates why the influence of the bucolic, love that word, bucolic village of Sandridge, with its ley lines and Gothic church, clearly that's at the heart of so much you actually work through.
Brilliant. It's 900 years old, our village. It's got a lot of history. And I love it. Yeah, and there's lots of countryside. I'm very lucky where I live, in the middle of nowhere.
Over three times the entire lifespan of the United States of America, though.
Yeah.
Just casually, oh, it's 900 years old. It's 900.
Yeah, 900 years old, that sort of basis. Extraordinary. Mark, have you enjoyed your return to the Midweek Drive? Now you finally
managed to. Yeah, no, thank you very much for having me, and thanks for persevering with me. So thank you. And
well, I mean, you know, Jessica, we even were considering one stage, she was going to postpone the graduation if you hadn't come on today, basically. So we even had to sort of work through all sorts of things on that basis, but never mind. So I take it sometime in the not-too-distant future when we've decoded the Morse code's signals, you may return.
Yeah, I'll come back on and tell you about the 48-hour album, well, song, actually, which is it's called Song for First Contact. So it's about first contact with ET, which is imminent, I think.
Yeah.
Look at that. Wow.
And on that bombshell, Mark Lee and Jessica Burgess, huge thanks.
Thank you. Best of luck anyway, Jess.
Sweet tea and creativity. Time for more Jessica Burgess questions on the Midweek Drive.
You know what they call sweet tea in the South?
What's that?
Tea.